Okay.
Most people are
email. So,
another opportunity to give a talk for you. And as usual, I haven't got a clue what I'm going to speak about until you start, except that beforehand, I'd love to try and expand upon little conversations we have in the reception area beforehand, where you can give me some feedback about, you know, where your spiritual life is going. And part of that spiritual life, you know, is seeing the beauty, you know, of just simple goodness in the world and understanding what real goodness is. Because goodness is not just keeping rules for rules' sake, it's understanding where those rules came from. Until you're not really keeping rules, it just becomes common sense to be kind and be virtuous and be trustworthy. It's just good fun. And sometimes people ask me about, you know, what's it like being a monk? You have all these rules to keep. Don't you feel oppressed? And quite frankly, being a monk for 40 years now, you don't feel oppressed at all. You feel this great sense of freedom. And why is that? Perhaps the very first little story, it's an old story from that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, which I haven't sort of mentioned for many years now. It was a story of the two monks who were in somebody's house waiting for lunch. And they were sitting in the room and they had a fish tank. I don't know, you may have a fish tank in your house. And one of the monks said, "That is cruel. What did the fish do to have to be put inside this prison in somebody's house? You know, it's bad to keep fish in a tank in your house just for your own amusement. The fish should be free to swim in the lakes and the rivers, to go where they wanted to. It is bad to imprison fish in a tank in your house." So, be honest, how many of you have got fish tanks in your house? Very good. Because the other monk said, "You don't understand." He said, "It's good to put fish in a tank in your house." "Why?" he said. "Because imagine that you were a fish. If you were swimming in the lakes and the rivers, you know, the people would be fishing for you, trying to kill you and eat you." And I often thought what it must be like being a fish in the rivers. Now you're swimming around, minding your own business, you see this nice juicy little worm. And you wonder, has it got a hook in it? Or is it a real worm? Because you've seen many of your friends. Now they see a worm, they take it, and suddenly they're yanked out of your existence, never to be seen again. It's like being abducted by aliens. That's what it's like to a fish. And you can imagine you've seen that so many times. Every time you see a worm or a fly, you don't know whether it's going to kill you or whether it's going to be eatable. Imagine that was you with your meals. Every meal you had, you didn't know whether this was going to be your last or not. You'd be paranoid. You'd be so tense that you would get the worst type of indigestion. So those poor fishes in the lakes, they must have terrible digestion. Because every food is a risk of your life. But the fish in the tank. I've never ever seen somebody take a fishing rod into your house and lower the line into your fish tank. You just don't do that. So the fish in the tank in your house are safe. They're not paranoid. They know that every food they get there is safe and they're going to live. So that's the first benefit of being a fish in the tank. You don't have to worry about fishermen. The second benefit is, you know, in those lakes and rivers, there's a big fish eat the little fish. And so these little fish swimming in the lakes and the rivers, you don't know when this big fish is going to jump out at you and eat you. And it's just like going to Cottesloe Beach. And the sharks. And imagine, it's really dangerous these days. You don't know when the shark's going to come and gobble you up. And that's what it's like every day. You know, every moment of a fish's life in the rivers and the lakes. It's really dangerous. You'll be scared. And again, those fishes in lakes and rivers, they must be so scared. They must be psychotic. They need psychotic. They need therapists. Because they're so scared of, you know, being eaten or killed by the fishermen. So they're not living a very happy life in those lakes and rivers. And number three, it sometimes happens there are floods. And if it floods, the water overflows and the fish get stranded on dry land. Sometimes it's droughts and there's not enough water for the fish. But in the tanks on people's houses, always just the right amount of water. It's so safe from natural disasters. And also, you know, it's been quite, sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's very cold. Now, next week I'm going to Japan, and I've just been told, -10°C. Oh, that's really cold. Coming from Australia, going to Japan this time of the year, that's freezing. It's snowing everywhere. So I've got to sort of accustom myself. I'm going to be meditating in front of the refrigerator in my monastery for the next week to try and get used to the cold temperatures. But anyway, don't be afraid of cold, because the colder it is, the longer you live. It's true. People in cold climates usually live much longer. The same principle as when you put the milk in the fridge, it lasts longer. It doesn't go off. You know the secret to long life? You know, if you want to know the secret of living to a long age, drink lots and lots and lots of long life milk. That's what it says on the packet, long life milk. Anyway. But in the lakes, or in its cold, sometimes it's hot, but in the fish tanks in people's house, it's like air conditioning. A constant temperature, just what the fish like. Next, if a fish gets sick or injured in the lakes and rivers, it just got to fend for itself. But if your fish get injured in your tank, you've got free health cover. You get a fish expert to come into your house, check your fish, and make sure they're healthy again. How many fish in the wild get sort of, even you don't get sort of doctors calling around these days. You've got to sort of drag yourself half dead to the hospital to get fixed up. But fish, they just swim there and the doctor comes to see them. And of course they never do without food. Like in the real life, sometimes they're hungry. They get, what's it called? It's like takeaway food delivered to their door 3 times a day sometimes, the fish. So the fish, said this monk, are free from so many dangers. Dangers of fishermen, dangers of bigger fish, dangers of natural disasters like floods or drought, dangers of too cold or too hot, dangers of lack of food, dangers of ill health. They're free of all those dangers. So if you were a fish, where would you like to live? When you put it that way, I want to live in a tank and get looked after. And just, you can spend all your day watching all these stupid humans. That's your TV. They will entertain you. So there is something to be said of sacrificing some freedoms for greater safeties. It's true the fish can't swim where they want to, but they're free of so many possible dangers and pains and sufferings. And that's how we always look at sometimes keeping like little precepts. They're keeping vows of ethics. It's true that if you keep any sort of moral principles, you can't go swimming where you would like to, in the bars and pubs and brothels of Northbridge. But I guarantee you'll be free from many, many dangers if you do that. Now, as usually, I try and tell one joke every talk. And I tried this joke out on a few people earlier, so here it comes. Sometimes I push the envelope sometimes, and this came from, he's not here, Rodney. Is Rodney here today? No, okay. He's a source of many jokes. And anyway, this was a bikie. You know these bikies, Hell's Angels, Comancheros, whatever gang they belonged to. And they were in the United States, the whole gang of them, cruising down the highway, looking tough. You know, in their glasses, their big tattoos and their leathers with their patches on the back, really tough guys. And they were about to cross a bridge. And they saw there was a big group of people on the bridge, including TV cameras and state troopers. So the head of the bikies decided to stop and find out what's going on. And he found out there was a person on the bridge about to jump off, commit suicide. And the head of the bikies thought, this is a very good opportunity to give the bikies a new image of kindness, helpfulness, you know, and be a hero for the day. The TV cameras were there. So the leader of the bikies gets off his bike, pushes his way through the crowd, right to the edge, and he sees this girl about to jump off. And he knows that everyone has been sort of trying to talk her out of it. So he tries something different. He leans over to her. And he's a really tough, good-looking, macho guy. And she leans over to him. He leans over a bit closer. She comes closer. And they kiss. And the TV cameras are rolling. And people are clapping. Yeah! Good one, bikey! And they kiss for about 5 minutes. Really passionate. And people are cheering. They really underestimated these bikies. These were people who try and help out others in depression and, you know, suicidal. What a great person this is. And when they finish the kiss and they smile at each other, the leader of the bikies said, wow, that was some kiss. Please tell me, why is someone as beautiful and can kiss like that? Why are you trying to commit suicide? And the answer comes, because my parents do not like me wearing girls' clothes. And they don't say what happened next, but I'm sure the bike can push you over. Anyway, I don't know where that fits in, but it's a funny joke. And all of you think that's a terrible joke, that's a bad joke. I bet you that you're going to go and tell it to your friends later on tonight or tomorrow. But anyway, let's go back to the being good. If you put yourself a little barriers around yourself, yeah, it is true, you miss out on some things, but you gain so much more. And that's one of the lovely things. We were talking earlier about sort of, you know, little things like stealing. Yeah, we all know that we don't go stealing sort of from each other, but we do steal from each other in a sense, and don't pay the taxes. You know, we so when it comes to the time of putting in our tax return. And I read about this because I was reading about the G20 summit over in Brisbane. And there's all these incredibly big, wealthy companies that are not paying tax in the places they do business. That's stealing. Yeah, it's not against the law, but it is unethical. I think we all know. And it's because, you know, companies and other people don't pay tax, it means you guys have to pay more tax, which is not really fair. It is stealing from you. And so that is something which is really unethical. But why do people do that? I think one of the reasons they do that is because, as far as ethics is concerned, they think it's just in the head, but it's not, it's in the heart. Well, this is one of the reasons or the ways I find out, you know, myself, you know, what's good and what's bad. People ask me these very tough questions sometimes, you know, these ethical dilemmas, and they come to the monks to try and sort it out for them. You know what I do? When you give me a question like that, I feel it in here. Does that feel right? Does that feel bad? Is that really cruel? Is that beautiful? When I feel it in here, this is much more trustworthy than, you know, all of the thinking and the logic and even the books. You feel this is right or this is wrong. Where I got this from, you know, it was quite natural, but this was really reinforced in, I never saw this, but people told me about it because I don't watch the TV, but there was a documentary done some years ago. And because I'm in my 60s now, one of the biggest events or biggest things which happened in my youth was the Vietnam War. You know, I saw many friends. You know, the friends I met in Thailand, they were in the Vietnam War. There were soldiers there. And you know, they got so fed up with the war, they went over to Thailand and became monks. And these are the people I grew up with, so it's very close to me. And I do remember that one of the terrible war crimes during that war was called the My Lai Massacre. And that was when a group of US troops were ordered to go into a village in Vietnam and kill every man, woman and child. And that was the order. It was wartime. And this documentary, this very very innovative, not innovative, but very sort of resourceful producer, decided to try and track down as many of those soldiers he could find 25 years later to find out how they were, whether there was any karmic effect of having followed that order and got into that village and killed women and children as well as men. And they found many of those soldiers, and nearly all of them were alcoholics, addicted to drugs, had no meaningful relationships with other people. They were socially and psychologically really messed up big time because of what they did. But apparently in all these documentaries, there's always one or two who are different, who stood out. And one of these was this African-American soldier who wasn't on drugs or alcohol, had a partner, very happy kids, and just having a happy life. And they wanted to find out why. And the reason was that he was, I think, one of only two soldiers who refused to go in. And they asked him, said, what happened after he refused? He said, I was put in military jail for about 3 or 4 years, which is really tough, those military jails. He said, but did you know that was what was going to happen? He said, I knew the consequences of refusing an order. Well, how could you do that? And he said he was a very simple guy in some ghetto somewhere in the United States. He joined the army because it was the only way he knew to get out of poverty, to get a life. He had not much education, but he said when he was given that order to go in and shoot every man, woman or child, he knew it was wrong. He said he felt it in here. He said he just couldn't do it. Even though he knew the consequences we'd be putting in this incredibly tough jail for 3 or 4 years for refusing an order, he just could not do it. And because he believed in here rather than in his head, tried to justify things, he refused. He did spend 3 or 4 years in jail, but afterwards he was this incredibly amazing, wonderful person. He had his self-respect. He had done what he knew was good. And this is something which I ask every one of you and everybody I meet. Whenever you have a decision like that, even if it's going to hurt you, please trust what you feel in your heart. And in your heart, you don't need to be a professor of ethics or philosophy at a great university. You don't need to be educated. In fact, education usually means you find all these smart reasons why you shouldn't follow your heart. But when you feel the heart, you know this will tell you more than anything else whether something is right or whether something is wrong. When I was a young schoolboy, you know, my parents were very poor, so I didn't have much money. And I had to go on a bus every morning to school and a bus coming back again. And I thought that if the bus conductor never asked for your fare, I didn't need to pay it. And that was an extra source of income for me. But there came a time when I was about 13 or 14, I felt very bad about that. You know, something inside of me said that was wrong, and it was like this intuitive feeling of what was right and wrong. No one was telling me, all my friends were doing the same. But then I thought, no, that you know, somebody's got to pay this bus driver's salary, someone's got to pay for the petrol, and I'm sort of cheating, I'm stealing. And I just made up my mind from that day onwards to always pay the fare, even when it wasn't asked. And I do remember many times at the end of the journey, I get off the bus and turn to the conductor and say, "You didn't ask me for my fare, here's the fare." And, you know, he was always smiling at me for doing that. And I took that up later on in my monastic life. I was incredibly honest. And you notice that when you do follow that heart, you do the right thing, you always find benefits. You never lose out. Because I do recall going, for those of you who know the hardware store Colley and Sons, we had an account in the hardware store Colley and Sons on the Brookton Highway in Kelmscott. And we were doing a lot of building in those early days. You know, I built most of the monastery down at Serpentine. And we got some wood from the hardware store. And there was so much wood, and there's customers behind us, so we were in a rush. And when I got the wood back to the monastery, I realized we got about $50 of wood we hadn't paid for. And it was just a mistake. So the next day I went back to the hardware store, you know, with the driver, and said, "Yesterday we bought this amount of wood, can you please bill us for it? It's about $50. And I do remember the cashier just looking at me as if I was from Mars. Just staring at me for about 1 minute, and they say, "Please wait here." And he disappeared, and I was wondering what he was going to do. And he came down, and he said, "I just talked with the manager. You now have a builder's account with our company, and you have 10% discount on everything you buy." And it only sort of cost us $50, to be honest, and we saved about $500 or $1,000 over the years buying from that place, simply because we were honest. And they knew that we were honest, and they wanted to acknowledge our honesty by giving a builder's discount. The builder's discount only goes for people in the trade. We were just monks. So that it's amazing what you can get when you're honest like that. And it also made me feel so happy that we could be trusted. And I remember in another hardware store, with all these builders and bricklayers and plumbers waiting in line, and I just needed to look at a sample of some, I think, Laminex, and it has this big folder, and I couldn't find a place to open it, so I was moving around trying to find some space, and I found some space behind the counter, and I put the Laminex book down, and it was one of these cash registers, you know, with this very sensitive press buttons. And I must have pressed the right button, because as soon as I pressed it, it went ding, and the drawer came out with all the day's takings in front of me. Thousands of dollars. And all of the people, all the builders and bricklayers and plumbers in the shop, they stopped, were silent, they looked at me, and they told the owner, "That monk is stealing." And to all intents and purposes, it looked that way. There I was, in front of the cash register, I would press the button and the till would come right out in front of me. But we've been doing business at that shop for such a long time. The owner was there, Roy Green, I still remember his name. He's retired now, his son's looking after it, Darren. Roy looked at me and said, "Those monks can't even touch the stuff." And he walked away with total trust, knowing that I couldn't even touch the money, let alone take any. And that really made my heart very warm. When there's that sort of trust, when you do a little mistake like that, people trust you so much that you are honest, that they don't have to worry about you. They can go and do their business. Isn't it wonderful if we could trust each other that much so we don't have to lock our doors? So we don't have to reinforce our donation boxes? So we don't have to worry whether we left the key in the car or not? It's beautiful when that happens. And sometimes we've lost that, but it's easy to regain it again when we have this beautiful sense of trusting one another, because we know, good people, we won't steal. We won't take what's not ours. Why? Because I don't want you to take what's mine, so you don't take what's yours. And that way we have this beautiful sense of trusting. It takes so many worries away. It's amazing just how much we have to pay for insurance just because we can't trust each other, and how we doubt one another. And that's not a very nice place to live. So you find out that taking something which isn't yours, it doesn't feel right. It's not good. And you feel that in here. And number two is just taking. That is not the meaning of life. You know, everybody knows that if you take something, you don't get much happiness. But if you give it to somebody else, you get so much more happiness. The old psychology test, giving students $10 each. Half the students go and spend it on yourself. The other half of the students go and give it to some charity or go and help some poor person or a kid, give them an ice cream, whatever it is. And come back afterwards, give them a psychology test to see which gets the best happiness. And it always occurs that if you have $10 and you give it to somebody else who really needs it, you get so much more happiness than spending it on yourself all the time. And I know that as a monk. I don't have $10. There's other things which I have. This was yesterday. Yesterday we had an ice cream. I gave it to somebody else instead of eating it myself because they dropped their ice cream on the floor. And that was my ice cream. It was a nice Magnum ice cream, and I looked at it, and it was nice, and I just wanted it. But I gave it to somebody else. And I got so much more happiness than eating it myself. Look at me, I've got enough in here. Just share it with somebody else. And have you ever done that? And you get great happiness. It's so easy and so cheap, and it makes life so much more beautiful when you share things with other people. I still recall, I think I've said this story, but it comes up because I go traveling so much. And I was going through Changi Airport once, and I saw this poor Western lady trying to get some rest. I know what it's like when you've been over an all-night flight, and you know, you feel really terrible. You just want to get a few hours of sleep before you get your connecting flight. And now she was on some sort of couch, trying to get some shut-eye, you know, moving all over the place. And I had eye shades, you know, from the aircraft. And I got out the eye shades. He didn't know me. I didn't know her. I said, "Have some eye shades, ma'am." And she looked at me and gave me this beautiful smile so she could put on the eye shades and have a rest and have some sleep. Now, just, I remember that. This gives me so much happiness. You help someone. I had the eye shades in my bag. I can get some more later on. So it's nice sharing and giving to people. Now that makes you feel good. You feel it in here. And every time you're kind like that, you give, you don't take. Every time you're trustworthy, it makes just such a great difference to your life. One of the other little anecdotes I recall was when, here's my lots of little anecdotes. It's nice to say anecdotes because it brings these theories to life. You may not know this, but before I became a monk, not only did I have green velvet trousers, long hair, I had a motorbike. And I was going to become a monk. And I knew enough about Buddhism that monks can't ride motorbikes. There's a good reason for that. Only once in my life as a monk have I ridden on the back of a motorbike. Once and never again. Because when you're on a motorbike with these robes, the air gets inside and it balloons up. And you have to hang on because everything is trying to blow you off. It doesn't work with these robes. So never again. But I had a motorbike when I was a layperson. A nice bike. And I thought, what am I going to do with this? I can't take it to Thailand. You can't ride a motorbike as a monk. And I don't need the money because monks don't have money. So I want to give it away. You know how hard it is to give away an expensive item? Because people wonder, what the heck are you up to? What do you want? Are you crazy? Is there something wrong with this bike? Is it hex? Is it black magic that you want to give away? Why didn't you sell it like everybody else? But anyway, I found a friend of my mother's who was interested. And he saw the motorbike and he said to me, he said, "How much do you want for it?" I said, "We'll go upstairs and we'll discuss it in front of my mother. And I need you to do this because you'll find out why in a moment." So he went upstairs to my mother's apartment and he said again, "I like the bike, how much?" And I said, "Do you really want it?" He said, "Yes, I want it. How much?" And I said, "Nothing, it's yours." And he looked at me. And again, one of those looks as if, is this guy from Mars again? And then my mother, the reason I did this in front of my mother, because my mother came up and said, he's okay, he's not crazy, he's not mad, he's just going off to Thailand to become a monk. She had to explain it to him before he'd take it. And I remember my mother writing to me after I got to Thailand and said, that fellow never forgot me, because it was the first time in his life that anyone had ever given him something expensive. And that just blew his mind. Just, there was an act of kindness there. That the world was not just all about money and buying things. It was about something much more of kindness and giving and sharing. It was easy for me because I didn't need it. And it was wonderful joy being able to give to somebody something that they needed. And no money, it's yours. Take it. Things like that give me so much happiness. And that's much better if I'd sold the bike and given it to some charity. No, do it charity direct and change a person's life. That's kindness. That's goodness. Now, this is just a few little things here, but you can understand what I mean. And that type of goodness, sometimes we call it giving. And we call it forgiving as well. I've been mentioning this in the talk I gave at the retreat recently, that giving is not just making donations in the box. It's not, you know, writing out a check for some charity. It's like giving others the benefit of the doubt. It's just expanding the circle so you can get some of the people who have been cruel to you inside, instead of always keeping them outside of your lives. And the way to do that is actually just whenever you think about someone who's hurt you, please remember that you've given them a trial inside your head. You've judged them, and you have been the prosecutor as well as the judge. And when I saw the way that I judged people and got angry at them and would not forgive them, I realized it was always an unfair trial. I was the prosecutor, I was the judge, and there was no defense attorney. And so I resolved, whenever I was going to judge someone, before I would get angry at them, I'd always force myself to have a defense attorney. Someone speaking on their behalf. Someone trying to find a loophole to make them innocent. Someone who's trying to find something about them which exonerated them, instead of always trying to find out that they were guilty. And as soon as I did that, it became so easy to forgive someone once I got my defense attorney on the case. And I noticed that when you get angry at someone, your husband, your wife, you are always a prosecutor, and there's no defense attorney allowed. And that's one of the reasons why we find it hard to forgive. So when we have a defense attorney, we can find reasons to forgive them. You can give them benefit of the doubt. They may have been in a bad mood that day. She may have had PMS. He may have just been drunk. Who knows what happened? But you can stretch probabilities and give them the benefit of the doubt. And that is such a more beautiful way to live, instead of always just being so suspicious of one another. When I do retreats in Jhana Grove, always in the evening we have question time. And one of the questions, I think last night, I hope the person's going to forgive me for actually bringing this up. She said, my husband is on the retreat with me, and he's looking at all the other pretty girls in the retreat. It's driving me crazy. What should I do? And it's simple jealousy. Now, this is what guys do. They look at pretty girls. Girls look at dresses in the shops, but you don't buy them. You can't afford them. You just look at them and just window shop, and that's okay, isn't it? Just looking. As long as you don't get your credit card out. And anyway, just, you're being so suspicious of that guy. You have this prosecutor and judge. Give him a break. Just get a find some reason why he's doing that. He's looking at all these other beautiful girls to remind himself that no matter how beautiful they are, he's married the most beautiful of them all. Stretch the truth. It doesn't matter. You're a defense attorney. That's what defense attorneys are supposed to do. And you know, when you stretch the truth like that, it's not really stretching it that far. It could be the case. But what it does, it means that you don't get into this terrible suspicion and negativity because you have another way of looking at people. And that feels so much nicer in the heart. You feel that is good stuff. Getting angry, what does that feel like? Being suspicious of people you live with, what does that feel like? This is where you find out what ethics are, what morality is, in here. Don't argue about it, feel it. And you will find it feels so nice to give people the benefit of the doubt. It feels so good to trust people. And even if they misuse the trust, if you're wrong, now they were having affairs with every other pretty girl in the retreat. It's much better to trust, because that is very, very, very unlikely. Trust is much better. It feels much more beautiful. And what I have found in my life, myself and also with other people, is if you do trust somebody and you give them the benefit of the doubt, they usually live up to your trust. If you're suspicious, they usually live down to what you're suspicious of. Same with yourself. If you trust yourself, you usually rise to the occasion. But if you're suspicious and doubt yourself, you tend to fail. Whether that's in some test, whether that's some interview for a job, or some assignment, if you doubt yourself, you fail. If you trust, have confidence, you can do it, you usually succeed. And that's exactly the same with other people. If you trust them, have confidence, they usually live up to it. If you're always suspicious and doubt and get angry, you make people worse. It's the old saying, watering flowers or watering weeds. Water flowers, flowers grow. Water weeds, the weeds grow. So you feel that inside yourself, what is really good and what is really bad. And the other question somebody asked me just before I came in was, again, on the ethics of euthanasia, you know, which is another topic which comes up again and again and again. So how are you going to find that and answer that? Feel it in here. Is that right? Is that wrong? Now with euthanasia, the terrible, terrible, terrible joke, first of all, which will make you think that I'd need euthanasia. Euthanasia is not the problem. It's youth all over the world. Youth in Asia. So that proves that I deserve to be euthanized. So people are shaking their heads in despair. But I'm sure no matter how bad a joke that is, you will tell it to your friends later on. They always do that. So anyway, but it's one of those problems which people have. You know, as a Buddhist, we're not supposed to kill. But then sometimes you see people suffering so much. Should they be allowed to suffer that much? And you start off with a very simple thing about euthanizing your pets. Is that a good thing for Buddhists to do? Kill your cat because it's really sick? Just put your dog down because he's got cancer? And that is the moral dilemma, isn't it? What should you do? And it's a very simple solution which I love telling people. And from there we go on to human beings. He said, if you have that problem, your dog has got cancer, your cat is the end of its life, and take it to the vet, and the vet said, there's nothing more we can do. I have to put it down. And you think, crikey, what should I do? This is a being I love. I can't kill it. But then I can't allow it to suffer so much. What should I do? And the point is, in Buddhism, just I say this in life, you have not got the right to kill anything. So instead, take your little cat aside and ask it, do you want to die? And don't think that's a stupid thing, because that works. I don't know if Judy's here today. She's often comes here. She did that with her little dog. I love telling the story. It's the best story of this particular ethical dilemma. She took her little dog to the vet. The vet said, "I'm sorry, there's nothing more I can do. We treated it for cancer a long time now." She spent a lot of money on the dog treating it for cancer. "Nothing more we can do. The dog's in pain. I've got to put it down." And she said, "I want a few moments with my dog." And she, you know, she heard me say this before. She took her dog aside into a corner of the vet surgery and she looked the dog in the eye and cradled it and said, "Have you had enough? Do you want to go?" And she felt in her heart, the dog didn't want to die. She felt it very clearly. She took the dog back to the vet and said, "No, I'm taking the dog home." And the way she told it to me, that dog, that sort of vet said, "You Buddhists," he knew she was a Buddhist, "you Buddhists are so cruel. You say you're compassionate and kind, and you're condemning that dog to another few weeks of pain and misery. You terrible Buddhists." He was really angry at her, because vets are very angry when they, you know, you don't follow their advice. But, you know, she took the dog home. And then she told me 6 months later she took the dog back to see the vet. It had made 100% full recovery. And the vet had a look at that dog, examined it. "You Buddhists are so wise and kind." He changed completely. And that's happened to many cats and dogs, which I know Buddhists have had. You haven't got the right to tell that dog has to die. But you ask the dog and cat, and sometimes you get the feeling back almost immediately. It's had enough. It doesn't want to suffer anymore. It wants to go. And then you take it back to the vet and say, "Put it down. It's not your choice. You've heard that from your cat. Your dog has told you." And then you just convey the dog's wishes to the vet. And then you aren't putting anyone down. You're not killing your cat. It's the cat's choice. And because that's your pet, and you love it, and you've been with it for such a long time, you know in here what it needs to do. And you follow that, and that's always the most wonderful advice. And you never need to feel guilty. You didn't kill the cat decided it had enough. Euthanasia. And that's the same with euthanasia. No one's got the right to put someone else out of their misery. Because usually you're just putting them out of your misery, not their misery. You don't like to see them suffer. It's your pain you're trying to get rid of. But if it's what we call voluntary euthanasia, in other words, you make that decision whether you've had enough. And I always say as a Buddhist in ethics that is your free choice. And the job of other people is to make sure it is a free choice and you're not being coerced. There's no sort of pressure on you to make a choice either way. You're not depressed. You are in full command of your faculties. And if you have full command of your faculties and you're making a decision based on the pretty much clear evidence of the doctors who tell you what the probabilities of recovery and what's going to happen to you, you have all that information and you make a clear decision. As a Buddhist, it is your right to make your choices. In Buddhism, for those traditional Buddhists, we say, you are the owner of your karma. No one else is, just you. And you make that decision. And I talk about this because for those of you who don't remember, the first person in Australia, actually the first person in the world, to have legally assisted voluntary euthanasia was a Buddhist from Darwin, Mr. Dent. He was a Buddhist, the first person to have legal voluntary assisted euthanasia. And I never met him, but one of the monks in our monastery did meet him. And he told the reason why he wanted to go for voluntary euthanasia. This is fascinating because you can understand this is direct from the source of someone who actually did it. And he said that he was in some degenerative disease with no quality of life, bedridden, had to have his bottom wiped when he went to the toilet. It was incontinent and could never get up. And he could be in that state for years, with no, literally no quality of life. And he said he didn't mind enduring that to the end. It didn't matter how long it took. But what he didn't like was the fact that his wife was giving him 24 hours care. She did get respite every now and again, but she thought, no, it's my duty to look after my husband, the guy who I love. It's my job. So she was sacrificing all her life to look after her husband. And he said he wanted to have voluntary euthanasia, not for his own benefit, but to free his wife so she could have a life. She looked after him long enough, and it could go on for years. He wanted her to be free. And when he says something like that, and I looked in my heart, I can't find any fault with that. That's good, that's kind, compassionate, looking, thinking of other people. So that's how I judge. You feel it in here. Unfortunately, that when we get something like voluntary euthanasia, people just start to think of what their religion says, or you know, what fear says, and they don't really feel it. And when they don't feel it, they don't get the right information. They make wrong decisions. So please, put aside what you've read. Put aside what you've been told. And if that case ever comes up for you, feel it in your ear, your heart. What is the right, what is wrong? And this will always be far more accurate than thinking. This is one of the problems of our modern world. We think that ethics are being owned by great thinkers in universities. And I went to a great university, and there's incredible thinkers in there, and I couldn't believe how stupid they were. It was one of the experiences I had. You know, you'd have dinner with Nobel laureates in Cambridge. And then every Thursday afternoon, I think it was Thursday, it could have been a Wednesday, I went to Fulbourn Hospital. I was volunteering that one afternoon every week for 2 years with Down syndrome patients. And that they blew me away. These were people institutionalized with Down syndrome. These days they're out in the community. Institutionalized. But those men and women, they were so emotionally intelligent. They knew their feelings. The Nobel laureates had no idea about their emotions. They were incredibly brilliant doing mathematics or, you know, understanding chemistry, but understanding themselves, they were just obtuse. And that's why I say I would go to these every Thursday afternoon, and some of these guys would run towards me and they'd look at me and they'd give me this big hug. What's wrong, they would say. I'd just broken up with the girlfriend. They would know straight away. Incredible. Their emotional intelligence, sensitivity, was amazing. And if I am emotionally sensitive to any of you when you come and ask questions, it wasn't my training in Thailand as a monk. I got that from these Down syndrome people I hung out with. They taught me how to feel. Because they were not very articulate anything else, but feelings, they were brilliant. They were geniuses. And that's where I ask you to feel your way through ethical dilemmas. Don't think about it, it just confuses you. And if you ask a person, is this right, is this wrong? You feel there'll be many cases when people are just don't have any quality of life and there is no real prospect. You feel in here this is the right thing to do. Other cases it's the wrong thing. You feel no, this is wrong, this can't be good. But this is where you know your ethics. And once you get involved in here and you can feel it, what's right, what's wrong, you can recognize very easily. And that will guide your ethical conduct much more powerfully than any set of rules. And that's where the mindfulness of the feelings in here, understanding that this is the seat of all which is good, and also you can feel what's bad, let this be your guide. And then you will never have any problems making decisions about what to do in very, what for some people are very ethically challenging. For you it's obvious. You feel it. And it's right. So there we go. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu. Very good. Okay, so now some questions from you guys. Is there any questions over there? From the floor, first of all. Anyone want to commit euthanasia tonight? Please line up. sometimes I'm a bit gross. Yes, question over here. Where's the microphone? Let's just shout it out now. Okay, microphone's coming. Here we go.
Oh, thank you. About the fish. If the fish has all this good life in the fish
tank,
bowl,
yeah.
Doesn't he? I think he won't have freedom to see more if he's not in the river.
Now this is a good question about if fish is in the fishbowl, they don't have freedom to go and explore and live just a full life.
So he's not happy.
He's not happy. Have a look in the fishbowl and feel, is that a happy fish or is it not a happy fish?
I think if there was a fish inside.
Yeah, if you were a fish, would
I
you
won't
be happy?
Happy. No.
Really? Now?
Because I don't have freedom.
Ah, now this is freedom. What does freedom mean? There are two types of freedom, and people confuse one with the other. The first one is called the freedom of desires. To be able to go where you want, when you want. And sometimes people feel that's a freedom, but it's not. It's very confusing. You have so many competing desires. You don't know which one to follow. There's literally too many choices. And it's very, very, very confusing, and it's a great burden for you. Now those fishes had another type of freedom. They had a freedom from danger. And this is one of the problems which we face in life. We have to balance the freedom from danger and the freedom of desires. Yeah, you may like to go and just ride in a car with 200 kilometers an hour. That's your freedom to do so, so people think. But you have many dangers. And so sometimes the people who care for you and love you say, no, you can't do that because we don't want to see you hurt. Don't see other people hurt. Is it right, the freedom to go out and get drunk and drive a car afterwards? I've seen one of the worst funerals I ever had to take was of a Chinese girl. Mainland China, she'd worked really hard. She got a scholarship to study here in Perth. She graduated and invited her parents from mainland China. One child policy, the only child the parents had. And she was showing them around Perth. She was walking in Gosnells when a drunk driver lost control of the car and slammed into her in front of her parents. She died. And when I saw those parents at the funeral, they could not understand any English. And they were just totally despair. I've never seen such despair. Their whole life they'd sacrificed, and all their hopes and their dreams lie in this one child who got so close, graduating, when she was mown down and died because of some stupid drunk driver. When you see things like that, you realize the freedom to do what you want is sometimes has to be limited. We have to put people in tanks, because when they swim around wherever they want, they create so much harm to themselves and others. It's how wide is that tank? That is the sort of interesting thing we can debate. But everyone has to live in the tank. There has to be some boundaries. And never think that those boundaries need to be broken. Yes, you can't swim where you want to. You don't have the freedoms. You have the freedom of from danger, the freedom from suffering. That's another type. So don't always think that freedom is doing what you want when you want to. It's also the freedom from danger, the freedom from harm, the freedom from suffering. It's a trade-off. And that's what that simile of the fish tank makes very, very beautifully clear.
Thank you.
Okay. You're married, you have a relationship. It means the boy's in the tank. You can't go swimming the usual places. Same with you. It's worth it. Any other questions? Anything on the internet? No questions there. Any other questions from the floor? Going? Going? Gone. Okay, great. Because I'm teaching retreats, so I'm going to go back to Jhana Grove afterwards. So have a wonderful evening. I'll be back again next week for another talk. All the best to you. Take care. We now pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhayami suvakkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.